My name is Bob Darrow, and I'm an alcoholic. Well, after we've soldiered through most of our amends, there's an easy feeling of being done. And we're not done. Alcoholism is a chronic condition, and like all chronic conditions, it requires regular, consistent treatment. Because of the natural, just like diabetes, the diabetic, every day his diabetes is a piece of business in his life, or else he will degrade down into what could potentially be a fatal condition. And the alcoholic's the same way. And so on step 10, we're told to continue. And to continue to watch for the manifestations of self. And step 10 is immediate. It's right in the now. It's right as I go through the day. I'm supposed to do five things. There's five components to step 2 that are done whenever I'm disturbed, whenever I'm upset, whenever there's any angst, whenever there's any conflict. The first thing I'm supposed to do is to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. So I watch. The second thing I do is I ask God at once to remove them. The third thing I do is discuss them with someone immediately. The fourth thing I do is make amends quickly, which 2-3 weeks later probably. Make amends quickly if we have harmed anyone. And the fifth thing is to turn my thoughts to someone I can help. So I watch, I ask, I discuss, I make, and I turn and move on. This is all very immediate stuff. And, you know, this book was written in 1939. And I think that the experience of Alcoholics Anonymous between 1939 in 1950, what they started to realize is that there was a lot of people that didn't catch it. You know, because the manifestations of self don't always present themselves in our perception as manifest. It's like I'm supposed to watch for selfishness. How many people here, when you're every time you're selfish, you know you're selfish? Right? We're supposed to watch for dishonesty. I mean, let's face it, there's dishonesty, and then there's having a little literary license with reality. I mean, that's not dishonest, that's creative. I mean, you know, just a little enhancements, a little tweaking of what happened. Supposed to watch for resentments. It's not a resentment if they're really wrong, is it? And we're supposed to also watch for fear. So when Bill wrote the 12 steps and the 12 traditions, he came up with the road sign. How do you know that it's time to watch, and then consequently ask, and then discuss, and make, and eventually the new default position of turn our thoughts to someone we can help? How do you know when you should be doing that? Because so many of us just roll through our lives, and we don't know. We don't catch it. And Bill came up with a road sign. And he said in the 12 steps and 12 traditions in step 10 that he believed it was a spiritual axiom, which means that's something that's true always under all conditions. That it's a spiritual axiom that when you're disturbed at all, no matter what the reason, no matter what the cause, if you're disturbed, there's something wrong with you. Disturbance is the sign that step 10 is immediately in that moment is needed. One of the things it says is we pause when agitated. Well, that's a new idea. Most of us attack when agitated, or charge, or run away. But to pause when agitated, and then to process, to turn towards God and to process all this stuff. These are not actions that come easily. They're not a natural thing for us to continually look for when we're wrong. It seems to be part of the alcoholic ego to have difficulty in admitting that we're wrong. Have you ever saw that one Happy Days episode? There was one episode, it was wonderful, where the whole episode was the Fonz trying to say the words, "I'm wrong," and he can't do it. He's going, he couldn't say it. Well, that's kind of alcoholic. I don't want to say I'm wrong. Even in a courtroom, when they have videos of me, like when the evidence is overwhelming, I will say, "Guilty, Your Honor," but with an explanation. And by the time I'm done the explanation, everybody in the courtroom knows that I don't really think I'm wrong. And if you're new here and you can't be wrong, ooh, you're going to have a hard time here. Because being wrong is a lot of what we do here. It doesn't say continue to take personal inventory and when you were right, promptly admit it. It's when you're wrong. And so I got to look and be willing to look, willing to see where I'm out of line. Where there's a disturbance in the force. When there's a disturbance, you all know what that feels like. It's that little bit of angst, that little, you start having, if the moment I'm having a conversation in my head with someone who's not in the room, I'm out of line. Right? I had a guy when I was fairly new, a guy named Dale I like Dale. He was a gruff old guy, but he did a lot of H&I. And so we became close because I did a lot of H&I. And Dale told me one time, he said, "Listen, kid," he said, "I'm going to tell you something that if you can buy it, it's going to save you a lot of grief." He said, "I want you to know that if you're explaining something, if you're defending something, if you're rationalizing something, or if you're justifying something, kid, I want you to know you're wrong. Because you never have to explain, defend, justify, or rationalize what's right." He told me that over 30 years ago. I've not found an exception to that. The minute the chatter comes on, right, I'm out of line. I'm out of line. I'm disturbed. I'm trying to justify myself, my position. The problem with all of that is it's a discontinuity. It's the beginning of separation. So I continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear when these crop up, not if, when they're going to crop up. They crop up. I mean, when you think about it objectively, if you're honest with yourself, have you ever had a day when you had no fear at all? I mean, were you just even a little bit of anxiousness or worry or... Have you ever had a day when you're not concerned with yourself at all? When you're not selfish at all? Have you ever had a day when you're not dishonest, even if it's just rounding up? Or rounding down. You know, you round down to make people think you're smart and get a good deal, and you round up to make them think you're a big shot. But there's no leverage in reality, so you round. You enhance. I never had a day. I never had a day. And then we start the 10-step promises. And these are the promises that brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I think you could get the 9-step promises and know a new freedom and a new happiness and not regret the past and still die of alcoholism if you don't get the 10-step promises. It is in the 10-step promises that we are realized a tremendous transformation that those of us that had been hooked into the obsession for relief. And here's, it says, "For we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol." Now that in it of itself is a fantastic promise. That would be serenity and that would be peace. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will see that this has happened automatically. We'll see that our new attitude towards liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. What an amazing promise. That you could get that free? That you could be free enough to have alcohol in your home and you wouldn't even realize it's there? To be so free that you could work around it every day? So free that you could go on a cruise ship and because you got a suite, they put a very expensive bottle of champagne in your suite, no charge. And when you walk in, there's no temptation. You just pick it up like it's cat poison or cat urine or something. And go give it to the guy who takes care of the stateroom. Say, find somebody who can use this. There's no temptation. There's no hook there. There's no pull. It doesn't look like medicine. It doesn't look like medicine. You get spiritually sick. It starts to have power again. And then you can't be around it because it starts to have a pull, because it starts to look like medicine if you're sick. I know that because the obsession started to return right in the middle of me stealing from my boss many, many years ago. I started, all of a sudden alcohol became fascinating again. Now, it doesn't mean I was buying a bottle and about to drink, but it started to look like something that had power again. Because here it says we were placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. If you put your car in neutral, you can rev the engine all you want. You ain't going nowhere. You're not engaging when you're in neutral. So that means that I can be surrounded by people that are drinking. I could have all kinds of experience. I worked around alcohol for 25 years of my sobriety. And what it promises here was absolutely true. It was like selling shoes. I tell you, I just got rid of this stuff about a year and a half ago. I had alcohol in my home for a long time. In my living room, where I have an AA meeting every Tuesday night, I had two redwood cabinets, really pretty cabinets, etched glass and really nice. And in those cabinets, there were 8 bottles of very rare, expensive cognac that the label, the fronts of the bottles were hand-painted by the artist Erte. And I bought them one time for investment, and I just had them there, and I forgot about them. I have a lot of artwork in my house, a lot of stuff, and they're just there. Nobody notices them. There's 50, 60 people come to my house every Tuesday night. That most of the AA members that are sober, well, they don't even see them. The new people, boing. They see, oh man, they see him the minute they walk in the door. You hear, hey, Jason, cognac. Yeah. But if you're placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected, it doesn't even mean anything. How does that happen? I think that's the great miracle here, isn't it? I remember times when I couldn't even be around alcohol. It would talk to me. I remember trying to sleep in someone's house one time, and there's alcohol in the other room. And I couldn't sleep. It was talking to me all night long. I couldn't sleep. It had power. It had such power over me. I remember I took a job one time as a bartender. I needed this job. My God, I needed this job badly. The guy gave me a really nice, going to pay me $200 over the table and $200 under the table. This is back when that was a lot of money. And man, it was a good job. And I knew me, and I knew I cannot drink. So I got it. Now, I can get through the shift, and when it closes the place up, I can drink. But I can't drink because I start drinking at work. I can't stop. I know the way I am. About halfway through that night, I had to break up a fight. They got the adrenaline going. Two guys started having a fist fight, and I had to break it up. And man, I was shaking from the adrenaline aftermath. And some guy said, "Man, you handled that pretty good. Let me buy you a drink." And I said, "Yeah." We're supposed to close the bar at 2 o'clock. The owner had to come in at about 12 o'clock because I was taking a nap on the floor behind the bar. Because once I start drinking, I got into that 100 proof Southern Comfort and I'm like pouring it down like water. Because every drink I take makes me feel like I got to have another one, and I got to have another one now. And I can't be around it without drinking. And here I am in sobriety, and I'm around it all the time. And it's almost like you're so free, you don't realize what had happened to you. How did that happen? Until if you work with a lot of newcomers, you see the astonishment in their face as they see how free you are. Right? You see how free you are. It's an amazing thing. And I'll tell you something. I believe that this position of neutrality is not extended only to alcohol. I think that potentially contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition, I can even be placed in a position of neutrality from me. You know that stuff that chatters to you in your head? When you're placed spiritually in a position of neutrality, what happens is that thing that scares you and worries you and drives you a little nutty becomes like music in the doctor's office. It's there, and it becomes like white noise. It doesn't have any power. It doesn't engage you. But if I get scared, if it gets my attention, it gets right here again. Then it engages me, and I'm no longer in the position of neutrality. And all of this is contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. It's not, thank God, it's not contingent on my spiritual condition, because I've had some days where I don't think I'd have measured up. I've had some days in sobriety where my spirit, when the day after I found out that my daughter and my ex-wife of 12 hours had moved in with my best friend sponsee, if my sobriety on that day was contingent on my spiritual condition, I'd have been screwed. But what it was contingent on was the maintenance of my... All God says is, look, just stay in the game. Just stay in the game, that's all. We know you feel like crap. You know you're sick inside. Stay in the game and you're going to get through this. Just keep showing up. Keep trying to trust God, clean house, and help others. Keep going to meetings. Stay in the game. And I like that because I can do that. I can't promise you my spiritual condition is going to be good. Some days it is. Some days it's so good. Oh my God, I should have a tent and a tambourine. It's good. I mean, it's really good. And there are other days where I just want to apologize for myself. Right? But I stay in the game. And I've never left the game here. I've never stopped taking the action. Sometimes I'm not a very good example, but I've never stopped here. And I get to survive myself here. And I think a lot of what happens in step 10, 11, and 12 is a vehicle for Bob to survive Bob. Because there's only one person here in the universe that will take me out. And that's me. And that's me. In order to stay sober a long time, you have to survive yourself. So I stay in the game. The book says it's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels, and it really is easy. There's a seductiveness that works in conjunction with the fruits of our sobriety and the chatter, the seductive chatter in our heads. I watch this, that second illusion that it talks about in chapter 3, where it says the delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, like if you were 10 years sober. You've been doing good for 10 years. How alcoholic could you be, for God's sakes? The delusion that you're like other people, or presently maybe, the book says, has to be smashed. Because what happens? Well, it's the same for everybody. If you come into Alcoholics Anonymous and you put all your chips in the pot and you throw yourself completely into this simple program, amazing stuff. All the stories you'll hear this weekend, all the stories you'll ever hear in Alcoholics Anonymous of transformation happen to you. You get a really good life, and with that, you start to feel really good. You're productive. You may or may not be rich, but you're getting by good. You're paying your bills. You're doing well. You're doing well. People are starting to respect you again. You start to feel good, almost good. Like I know I'm an alcoholic, but God, I don't feel like an alcoholic anymore. When I was in detox, I felt like an alcoholic. And it's very seductive, isn't it? Because self-centered people that are self-centered by nature have a tendency, as I've always done, to gauge how I'm doing based on how I feel. And so what happens to so many of us is we get seduced by the very fruits of our own recovery into a false sense of okayness. And what happens as you start to feel like the problem has faded, you start diminishing the actions that put you in that position. You don't even know you're doing it. It seems like a natural course of events. The problem is that alcoholism is unforgiving. It doesn't care. No, chronic illnesses are unforgiving. Diabetes doesn't care how good your blood sugar was last week. And alcoholism doesn't care how great a job you did in the maintenance of your spiritual condition last week. Today's alcoholism is a new piece of business. And you don't build a house of recovery and then destroy it overnight. You do it brick by brick, incrementally, as you compromise your actions in this deal. And the problem is, you don't know which. It's like that thing where you pull out the bricks and you keep pulling, and then one time you pull out one and the whole thing collapses. You don't know where the collapse point is. You just start pulling out. You pull out a little. You pull out. Oh, 7 meetings a week. Well, I'm going to pull. I pull 2 of those out. See, I'm still good. So stand. See, I can do 2 less meetings. It's good. I'm not going to call my sponsor as often. Matter of fact, I don't really have anything to tell him. I will call him if I ever have a problem. I'll call him after I get through it to tell him what I did in case he ever needed that. And that's maybe 2 more bricks you pull out of there. And then, you know, me and God, I'm in a pretty good routine. I throw a prayer at him every once in a while. We're good. Okay. I'm not good at this meditation thing. It's nice if you're not busy. But I'm busy. I got a big life. And pull out another little brick and... And the amends, well, you know, I think amends are good. There's a few people that owe me amends. They're good. And if I'm ever really wrong, which, you know, I haven't been in a long time. If I am ever really wrong, I would make an amends. And you pull out a couple more bricks. And then one day you pull out the one and it collapses. And do you know that someone who drinks again after 15 years, the week before they drank again, they'd have bet anything that they would never drink again? Because the structure appears to be sound until you pull out one more brick and it collapses. So we maintain this thing. And with this, we get a life and we get freedom. Freedom from the only thing we need to be free of. We get intermittent freedom from ourselves. And that's a pretty good deal. Sheldon.
Give you just a couple of quick examples of my life and how step 10 has been important at protecting me from myself and keeping me on this track. I mentioned that I worked for the same company for 14 years, and I had this boss that over those 14 years he made me crazy. He made me crazy to such a point that I would snap periodically and, and you know, say something inappropriate or yell at him or call him a name or, you know, the kind of stuff that you do when you just get really frustrated. I go to my sponsor and you tell me, you know, you got to go make amends for that. I call him up and I tell him, this guy is really just on my last nerve. Well, he'd say things like, have you ever considered that maybe he had a tough day at home with his wife? Maybe she yelled at him before he left the house for work. I don't care about that. Well, but have you ever considered that? You ever thought that maybe his boss, you know, we've all got a boss, maybe his boss is breathing down his neck and that's why he's breathing down your neck? Well, I don't know, I suppose. Well, what did you do? Well, I called him this or I told him that. I said, well, you got to clean that up. You got to go clean that up with this guy. And he'd always make me feel like I was wrong. And I'd go to the guy and I'd clean up the mess and it always looked the same thing. Bob's got this thing about in the workplace, if you have an amends to make, a nice way to do it is to find out how the person takes their coffee and then take him to Starbucks. Right? You think he had stock in Starbucks or something. But I'd make this guy mad and I knew he liked the vanilla latte. That was his thing, right? I'd show up at his office time after time. He'd see the Starbucks in my hand and he'd know what was coming. You know? Oh, is that for me? I bring him the Starbucks and tell him I'm sorry. You know, I hated the guy. I mean, the guy just really bugged the living daylights out of me. But he didn't know how much he bugged me. And I stayed at that company for a long time and I got promoted and good things would come my way, and I ended up being the general manager of the dealership, and I would go to Bob, and I'd say, you know, that guy hates me, and he wants to fire me. And he'd say, well, what evidence do you have? Is it the raise they just gave you? They gave me a Rolex one time. He thought that was the best thing of all. So that's the evidence. They only give Rolexes to people that are getting ready to fire. Well, this one particular time, this guy calls me. We were closed on Sundays. Car business in Vegas, I'm not sure what it's like here, but in Vegas, the dealerships are closed on Sundays. So it's Sunday, it's family day, I'm at home with the family. And he calls me and he says, hey, tomorrow morning I want you to start your day at my office. Click. First of all, it's Sunday, right? I mean, what right does this SOB have to call me on family day, right, and get me thinking about work and make piss? I mean, it's just not right that he would call me, first of all, on a Sunday. Secondly, for me to start my day at his office means I got to drive 30 miles to the east to get to his office, 20 miles to the east to get to his office. My office is 60 miles from my house to the west. This is 80 miles out of my way. This isn't, you know, two hallways down in the same building. This means an entire half a day is wasted. I got to drive to his office, then I got to drive to my office. This is a pain in the ass. And he's not going to ask me to do that because he wants to borrow a pen, right? I mean, there's clearly something going on here. And this guy is not a nice guy. If he wants me to go to his office and he's calling me on a family day to go to his office on Monday morning, he's obviously got something on his mind and I can't imagine what he could have on his mind. Because you know why? Because I'm good at my goddamn job. And I'm not really sure what this guy might have that he wants to talk to me about. See, I'm at a level in the company where I don't only get my department's numbers, I get the other department's reports to his numbers. And believe me, he's got some freaking problems in those other departments that he could better spend his time on Monday morning dealing with than getting in my way of me being successful. And now, I'm mad. And I tell my wife, I'm so sick of this guy. God damn it, I am so sick. She goes, you know, you're right, honey. You should quit. That's why she's my wife, not my sponsor. I say, I'm going to quit. I'm going to write out a letter of exactly what I want to say to him. Because you know what happens? I get in his office and I start talking to him and I forget what I'm going to say. So I'm going to write out and I'm going to get to his office and I'm going to go in there. And before he says anything, I'm going to say, before you say anything, let me speak first. And I'm going to read my letter to him. She said, that's right, honey. Before I do, I'm going to call Bob. She says, don't call him. Oh, not him. Call anybody, but not him. I call him. And I start telling him what's going on. And he starts giving me this line of crap about, you know, well, who knows what's going on. Maybe he's getting pressure from his boss. I think you're overreacting. And I lose my mind. Now, he's not a guy that yells at me, and I'm not a guy that yells at him, but I lose my mind. I go, I can't believe this. Again, one more goddamn time. This is like 16 years sober. 16 years I've been coming to you with this guy and the way he treats me and the way that this is, and every time you're on his goddamn side. You know what? You say you love me. But you always take their side. Why do I have to be wrong? Why do I always have to be wrong? Why am I always wrong? And he's how? And he says, Sheldon, let me ask you a question. I go, what? He goes, do you have a good life? What kind of question is that? Do you have a good life? I guess. Well, do you have a good marriage? Yeah, you know I have a good marriage. You have a good home? I have a beautiful home. You got any money in the bank? I got a few bucks in the bank. You got any nice vacations planned? Yeah, I got some vacations planned. You got a nice car? I got a nice... What? What? Yes, I have a good life. He says, you have a good life based on being wrong. Why would you want to be right now? Hard to argue with logic like that. So I get up the next morning, I drive down to this guy's office, and I walk in his office, and I'm getting ready. I go, hi. He goes, I'm glad you're here. I've been working on this project, can't find a solution to my problem. I thought you'd be the right guy to be able to help me. I'm thinking no, but I got his phone number if you want to call him. But I'll try my best. Apparently I'm not the right guy because I'm usually wrong. I'll come up with a solution. You do the opposite. We'll be fine. I retired from that company in August of last year. It was too many hours. I heard somebody say at that meeting we had earlier that it just didn't. She has a job that didn't fit with her current lifestyle, the choice of her life. That's what happened with this job. It's a great job, paid me a lot of money, but I want to spend some time doing some other stuff. So my wife and I decided that we would shrink our lifestyle a little bit, and I'll try and find something else that gives me a little more free time but pays me a little less. And so we did that in August. In October, I got a phone call from a friend that works at Drexel University. They had some problems in their business development. I'm a business development sales specialist. She said, can I show them your resume? Maybe we can get you to come out to Pennsylvania, to Philadelphia for a few months as a consultant. I said, sure. I mean, they're not going to hire me. I barely graduated high school. I stole my diploma on the way out of there. This is a freaking major university. They don't want my help, but sure. Show them my resume. I show them my resume, and they hire me, and they asked me to come out to Philadelphia. And I spent from November until the second week of February working at Drexel University, flying back and forth. It was an amazing opportunity. It was supposed to be until May. I was supposed to be until May. But when I got there, some things happened that made me afraid. And at the time, because of the way my mind works, I thought I was justified in being afraid. I thought I was being threatened. I wasn't being threatened. These guys have a different way of doing business than the way of doing business I'm used to doing. That's all. But I thought that I was being threatened. And when I think I'm being threatened, man, I want to pause when agitated. I do. I'm better at it than I've been in the past. I mean, I survived 14 years at that one company with pausing when agitated. I'm usually pretty good at it. Man, I wish I would have said to them, I'm not feeling very comfortable about this conversation. May I take a walk for 5 minutes and come back and finish this conversation? But I didn't. I just was afraid. And I acted like a scared person. And they're not... The car business is an interesting business. You can say some things in a business meeting in the automobile industry that you can't say in higher education. You would imagine. And I had a mental lapse, and I forgot I was in higher ed, and I thought I was in a car business meeting. And I talked to them like car salespeople, and they're in higher ed, and they went. I made a softball apology for it at the time. I didn't do it right. I didn't do what we're taught to do. I made a softball apology at the time. And they decided, without my permission and while I wasn't in the room, that they were going to shorten my contract. And they were so kind and so gracious. They made up a story that for budgetary reasons, and I believed them at the beginning of the journey, they said for budgetary reasons, we're going to have to cut your contract short. And can you stay for another month and finish up some of the projects you're on? But by the time I left, you could feel the separation. By the last week that I was there, even though they were still singing the same song about the budgetary stuff, and maybe there was some truth to that, I don't know, but you could feel separation in the office when I walked in. And I knew that I'd done wrong. I came home and I talked to Bob about it. I could see things clearly that they should have done differently. I could see them clearly. If I wanted to be in the justification game, I got some. I do. And I tell you, if you give me 15 to 20 minutes, if I'm in the right mood and you're in the right mood, believe me, you'll see it my way. But that's not Alcoholics Anonymous. At some point, we have to do AA. What does that mean? It means we put out of the minds the wrongs others have done. It doesn't matter what they've done. What did you do? I got afraid. I reacted when I shouldn't have. I got afraid for no reason. And I reacted badly to that fear, and I trapped people with disrespect. So I said to Bob, I said, so I gotta call this girl, or actually I know her real well, we've been friends for a long time. She's the girl that got me the job. I said, the way that she works and operates, she would prefer an email. He says, the book says direct amends. And God's got a sense of humor, because I was asked to come out here about a year ago. And God said, we better make sure he comes out here now, because he's going to need to be in Philadelphia to make some direct amends. God is an amazing choreographer. Amazing choreographer. Just so happened that a week after I could see clearly what the amends had to be made, I was going to be in Philadelphia on Friday. I sent her an email and I said to her, I was wondering if you would be willing and able to have lunch with me. And I got to have lunch with her on Friday. And I sat down with her to have lunch. And we chatted about bullshit for a few minutes. And I said to her, I got to talk to you. I want you to know that I felt threatened when I wasn't threatened. I got afraid of stuff when I shouldn't have been afraid. And I didn't react well to the fear. And I treated you with disrespect. I'm really sorry for that. I let you down. Is there anything else that I did wrong? Which was scary. Because I knew there was. but I couldn't see it. And she told me what I did. And asked her how I could make it right, and then she gave me some action she wants me to take with her boss, and I'll take those when I get back to Las Vegas on Monday or Tuesday. And then she said to me, is there anything that I did wrong? Mm-hmm. Boy, a few years ago, that question would have been the gift of... I'd have said to you, when she said that question, I'd have said, see, AA works. And I said, no, absolutely nothing. Your behavior was above reproach, and I'm grateful for the way you treated me. Because I'm doing AA. When we left, she gave me a hug, and she told me that we were still friends, and she sent me a couple of texts since then, telling me that she was grateful that she's a member of AA, telling me that she was grateful to see AA in action. This woman helped me get this job because she's one of my wife's closest friends. You know what I could have done? My wife's the loyalest woman in the world. I could have told my wife that I wouldn't have had to, I could have just said, you know, she's being a, and I could have killed that friendship. I could have hurt my wife. I could have hurt her. I could have done all those things because my ego needs to be fed and strong. I'm 18 years sober. I'm better than I was 18 years ago. But I still make mistakes. I still do things wrong. I still screw up. The only thing that I'm going to ask God for about situations like this is that He allows me the grace to not have to defend myself to the point where I will not allow myself to see that I am wrong and that I am flawed. I think that I could survive something like this again, provided I don't dig in and demand that I'm not right, I'm not wrong, and that they are. It is our ability, our collective and individual ability, to admit that we are human, that I am human, that I make mistakes, that I am often wrong, that enables me to live in a world with people who often make mistakes and who are often wrong. If I hold you to a standard where you're unable to make mistakes and I crucify you for the mistakes that you make, I will treat myself in a way where I am unable to make mistakes and it's unacceptable when I make mistakes. If I can see myself as a flawed individual, as a guy that's just doing his best, if I can let myself off the hook, perhaps when I'm lucky on a good day, I'll get to see you as flawed individuals that are doing the best you can, that are just trying to get by. It'll allow me to reduce the separation enough to join the human race. My sponsor always used to use the phrase that the dogs of judgment will always bite their master. I heard someone say a long time ago in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys have all heard this before, I'm not telling you anything you haven't heard before, that it says in the Lord's Prayer that we say at the end of the meeting, forgive us our trespasses. Forgive me for the crap that I do wrong. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those that trespass against us. In the same way, to the same degree, to the same amount, at the same time that I forgive those that trespass against me. For as long as I am willing and able to see the flaws in my makeup, to embrace them and then to try and give them to God, I'll be able to let you off the hook for the flaws in your makeup. And I'll be able to join the human race.